You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Vivek Narayanan. Vivek, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Vivek, I know you're going to be reading today, but some of your poems. But to begin with, what are you working on now at the moment?
So what I'm working on now is actually what I've been working on for the past 6 years, almost exclusively, and I'm still in the middle of it, which is what I'm calling a writing through of the oldest Sanskrit epic poem, Valmiki's Ramayana. So it's a project that involves aspects of translation practice, but also tries to go beyond that. And you know, I'm trying to move into a space where the distinction between translation and original writing would not exist. And so this was something that I guess, you know, started, I thought, would be a very quick project, but Valmiki is a long book. And although I'm translating only fragments of that book, the sense of epic scope means that this has sort of turned out into a kind of a four-volume project, and I'm sort of just put the last full stop on the second volume, so I'm about halfway through it.
That's exciting, and that sounds daunting in a way. The idea of there being no space between, as I understand what you're saying, the original writing and translation sounds very sort of dreamy. That's what we would all love. But how is that possible to reduce that space so much? That seems like an impossibility. It always seems like it's translations are always approximations, and sometimes worse.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing is that, this is my sort of take on it, which is that what we think of as translation today is really something that's more like a kind of lexical translation. And I feel that this is, in fact, if you look at all of history, the norm is what we would think of today as more sort of creative or freer translations, and so the Ramayana, the strange Ramayana text that I'm working on, each time it's sort of gone into a new Indian or Asian language, it becomes kind of reinvented, sort of almost rewritten. So as, for instance, the Tamil poet Kamban, he's doing his Valmiki, and what he does is that at night he studies all the different Ramayanas, and he studies the text closely, and then he goes to sleep, and he wakes up and he writes his Ramayana in Tamil. So even if I'm sort of during the day, if I'm working on studying a passage closely, I always feel like I should have to take a nap to have it be alchemized somehow. So I would feel like that is, in fact, for all of history, this idea of a translation is a kind of rewriting and an invention, and as an addition rather than a copy, you know, just rather than a sort of straight copy. Anyway, go ahead.
But that's fascinating. I mean, that takes it out of the realm of being a purely academic idea, of course, which it's not. But
right.
You know, therein is, I would think it's difficult, the idea of which rings so true, the idea of kind of sleeping on it and then,
right.
You know, then writing sounds like it makes so much sense, but that's also very hard to grasp. It's not exactly a method.
No, it's not. It's definitely not a method. I think it's an embracing of many possible methods. You know, sometimes I feel like every, you know, every translation in a way is an encounter between two souls. And so I've said that, you know, I really do believe the translation is a kind of soul fusion technology. So it becomes a way in which the sort of translator, the reader, and of the writer become kind of fused, you know. So I think that it's I know it sounds it seems like a kind of a fantastical realm, but translation is, once you have the provisional idea of a translation, which is not as something like an exact copy or a kind of authentic, you know, sort of word for word, you know, this idea of the lexical translation. Once you open out it to a kind of a toolkit, a set of possibilities, it's something that's kind of happening all the time in our world, and I think it needs to happen more often. You know, I think in the U.S. is making a transition from being a monolingual country to a more bilingual country. But in India, over the course of a day, you habitually move through at least four or five languages, you know, when you're out in the city.
And I know you're going to read from us bit. So I'd love to hear something. What's the first work you're reading?
Right. This was a book of fragments that I've been working on, but somehow I think because it sort of just started to come together as a book, I've started to feel reluctant about excerpting from that Valmiki book. So perversely, I thought of actually reading a couple of poems from my previous book, which is called Life and Times of Mr. S, and then a kind of outtake from what I'm working on now. So the two poems from my previous book, I'll just say that these poems are both prayers. Short prayer to the economy. Prayers for fishes tossed each to each in translucent glue. Prayers for the hairier beasts roistering in rolling tundra. If we're to conceive a world, let us conceive it at all risk, one. Prayers for the wily bicycle, knight of secular propulsion. Prayers for the uncoagulated human residue, impossible to weigh in balance, and our economy that intricate grows beyond forbearance. I found I don't know, I need to know, who can I talk to, who can I call, what must I do, where must I put it, how can you use it, what is your number, who will you call, where will you go, how will you make it, where will we put it, who can I finger, how will they take it, where is the button, how can I find it, how did he get there, who does he know, what can it do, where does it go, how do you work it, what will it work, take what it'll work, if you do how it does where, what can it do, who does he know, who did he get there, how did he find it, how is the button, where will he take it, how can I finger, who will we put it, where will we make it, we will go where, call you what, who, number who, how, must I put where, I can, I need, I don't, I found, I feed. Prayers for the musical crow, the intimate mosquito whose kisses are here to say. Prayers for the contract killer, the contractual signer, unspeakable, unimpeachable bond, and our shared godless theology that hooks the day to day. Prayers for all projectiles, red, yellow, somewhat bluish, spinning inert, riskily pulsed. Prayers for gashes of quarried stone, saunas of smelted aluminum, ever thinning veins of copper from where the monstrous weather grows. Feed, I found, I don't know, I need, know, to can, who I to talk, who can I call, what must I do, where put I must, how number who, what you call where, go will we how, it make where it, put we will, who finger I can, how it take, they will, where button, there is, how find he did, how he get there, who know he does, what where it does, how do you it work, what take it work, how will I find it, I can how the button, it make me we how, where call you will, who number your is what your use I must put where I do, I ran, I call, I can to talk, I need, I don't, I found, I've prayers for the intestinal tract whose winding road grows hidden. Prayers for the rickety aeroplane suspended in the air. This prickly fog will take us. Will all of us be spared? Prayers for every scrawny stick uncountable, each that I know by name. Prayers for the murderous author, the deadened reader, the wakening good. And lastly, that arithmetic knot of our making, its obsolete fire.
Thank you, Vivek. Such a beautiful piece. I want to ask you a little bit about also the reader having, you know, this is, of course, you're the poet reading, but you know, we were just talking about the kind of translation and the way you were looking at it, and while you were reading, especially in the moments where, you know, the rhythm picks up, the tempo picks up, and there's this list of kind of chores, of thinking, of things to do, you know, it becomes so engaging to hear you read that and to come back to that like a song. It has a music to it, and what I'm asking is, when that could of course be read by different people in different ways, and the way you read it has a particular pace to it that I find enormously engaging. I'm getting excited, and I think, yes, that's me. I'm with you. You know, what do you think about the fact that that's a very hard thing to translate? How does the reader read it, or another person speak your poem? Because wouldn't it lose something, not in translation, and I don't want to say lose something, but there's a different tone when we don't hear the poet reading the way it was intended.
I think that the moment it goes down on paper, right, you know, I read this poem for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, I think that somewhere, even, you know, especially with translation, or as I imagine it, in of poetry. Now, you know, the Ramayana has been translated as story, but I'm really trying to kind of put forward the role of poetry, the sort of place of poetry. And so that is kind of really intimately linked to sound, you know. And so it's sometimes, I think, you know, I hear the text producing a sound that I then have to kind of call back to. Like I'm producing my own sound, which kind of calls back to the work to Valmiki in this case, or to other things. So the sound is a kind of integral element of what a poem produces, but not the only one, because when it sort of sits there on my desk, I am struck by the fact that it's also really just a pure conceptual idea, and you know, language is fundamentally abstract, you know, and so it exists as a structure of thought that, you know, when it goes down on the page, it has to invite many different possible performances. And in fact, of this particular poem, there's a friend who's a composer, and there's a band who does it. And I explicitly didn't want to recite with the band because I wanted to be able to see other performances possible. And so to go back what you're saying about the reader, you know, I often think that. And there's a lot of talk about creative writing, but what we also need is the creative reader, you know, and poetry really sort of demands a creative reader to somehow be able to listen, you know, and so that's the bridge that the reader has to make, is to somehow expand their range of hearing Now, to hear the poet perform the piece can be helpful, but I think it can also be harmful. You know, I mean, I think that I wouldn't want that to be able to kind of shut down or sort of produce a kind of authoritative performance of the poem as it exists on the page.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that makes sense, and it's so interesting to hear you talk about the musicality of it and how the idea of a creative reader. I mean, it's really
right.
Why I love hearing poets read and why I hear you read, and perhaps it does encourage other readers to read as creatively, you know, which to me almost means the way you would read. When I was first reading to my son as a child, I remember reading somewhere about that, you know, you should be creative with this, get excited, you know, do what you like with the text. Don't read it in a way that's dull or it'll be perceived that way. So I know you have a few more to read for us. What are you reading next?
So another prayer, shorter than the one I just read. This actually continues the theme. This is a short prayer to sound. Sound has the particular quality of being visible. It is the greater God. Vision in evening's fog shows a man on the cycle with his newspaper bags, the threaded breeze of his hair, the holes of his eyes. Yet, though riveting, vision knows nothing of his pain. Sound does, for sound is pain, curled and garbled by the ganglia, stunned and suppressed, dim thundering from some secret window. Never regular, though it may sometimes seem so, never present, though it may seem, rivet of moment to moment, a sack on the face with holes to see, imprecise as a world seen through cloth, ease of the friend that follows, agony internal to the shape, the tinier holes through which a quality refines, a private lack, a riveting in, some riveting act. What does sound carry? It will not tell. It refuses to be known. So close to us, clinging, it will not tell. He wants to gather memories in its sack, as if memories in the brain-shifting imagos had actually the tangible quality of being gatherable. Alas, sound is forgetting. It has already been forgotten. It is the hole into which all know-how disappears. A whole we can only call the future. Yet, like peas in a pod, like arguments in the agora, it follows tracks.
Thank you. Lovely, lovely piece. Very beautiful, and I guess picking up on what we were saying before. It's hard for me to even ask a question about this, but sound itself, like music, is the most ephemeral of arts, it seems to me, which of course is poetry too, and that's it's a beautiful way to talk about sound, because it's something all poets think about, and again, the reader, as you were talking about, the creative reader doesn't hear the sound unless they're listening to the book, and even then, who's reading the book? So it's
right.
So the sound itself is to me fascinating in terms of what you're saying, and seems to make me think about the idea of how the reader also brings sound to words, because that's what the reader is also doing, aren't they?
Right. Yeah, absolutely, and every reader is going to bring, you know, a different set of sounds to the reading, and we'll have to expand. But I also, like, I mean, I I like performing the work because it's kind of like sort of switching it on. And so in some ways, I think that, you know, the performance, my reading of the poem, I would treat that as much as a publication. You know, it's a kind of a publication of its own. And so I think that, you know, and I think all of us bring different kinds of inflections to language, right? We have a different sort of soundtrack to that we bring to the language that we're speaking and working in. And so, you know, this idea that everything is only contained on the page, and that sort of understanding the sort of the voices or the people behind the poem should have no effect at all. I don't really buy into that. I think that part of expanding our hearing, expanding my hearing certainly has been, you know, going to poetry readings. Like I think John Ashbery, to hear him read was a very special kind of revelation into his writing. Though once I had begun to hear my own version of a John Ashbery voice in my head when I read, you know, one of his poems, then I no longer could listen to him read them out loud. So,
yeah, that's so interesting, right? How we go back and forth that way. I'd love to hear one more piece. This is from what you're working on now, what you're about to read?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, as I said, somehow I feel a strange reluctance to excerpt from the work that is, the books that are done, but this, I'm not sure if this will make it in, and so it's in a way, so I'll just read it, and, Lehian, lickable foods. The commentator quoted his own grandfather's poem to explicate a line of the epic. Mahavega, very fast. When mountains had wings, the scourge among gods was to amputate them. Rurodha hridaye pranan, stopped in his heart those breaths. That's it.
And talk to me a little bit about that, because this is from what you're working on now. This is also about translation itself.
Yes, I mean, where do I begin? I think one of the Ramayana is maybe a good place to start, right? One of the most influential and probably, you know, perhaps the single most influential epic poem in Asia, you know, versions felt everywhere, and the fact that it can be kind of retold constantly is part of its power. So we, in English, we have a sense of the Ramayana as in terms of the story, and as I mentioned, I wanted to be able to kind of recover it as poem somehow, and partly that has meant sometimes even sidestepping the narrative, though I do go look at some of my poems are in this project are narrative poems, but at other times I sidestep major aspects of the narrative to focus on something very minute. You know, like a sort of a little piece of a glint of something, a little fragment of something. And in Sanskrit, that's very often where the poetry happens. So this is a sense of kind of collecting all of these fragments, sort of reconstituted from the text. From Pound, I learned you don't have to leave out the original language. So the Sanskrit comes back in, and other languages come back into the text. And so it's a kind of it's a reading, but it's a very peculiar reading, I suppose, by sort of zeroing in on fragments, which is I think, I guess that's what's happening in this poem, or poem fragment that I just read.
And that will be part of the four volume work that you're currently have in process?
I haven't found a place for it yet. But I might have a place for it. I mean, in the sense that part of the reason why I haven't been able to really work on anything else while I'm in the midst of this is that I feel like I want to be able to put all of who I am or what I'm thinking into the work of the translation, as sort of rewriting the writing through. So what happens is the way it accumulates is through these kind of jottings that happen, and sometimes I extend them, sometimes I work with them in all kinds of ways. I don't know what the status of this little fragment that I read yet is.
I like that. I like that because it also seems hard to grasp for me, and I like that. It feels like if I was reading many more of those or a book like that, and I know this probably isn't your intention, that something would happen to me that would seem is between the lines or not even of the word.
Yeah, that's absolutely my intention. That's absolutely my intention. I mean, I don't refuse narrative, but I also have a number of these sorts of poems that I suppose have sort of gaps in them, and just as you say.
I like that so much. Vivek, it was really a pleasure hearing
you. Oh, thank you.
And talking about this. I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment, the question I always am interested in.
Yeah. First thing I thought of actually, and I suppose you could call it reading, technically it's listening, is a lot of Julius Eastman, the composer, and listening to him with a certain kind of close attention itself also. It feels like a kind of reading. Another person is Nathaniel Mackey, who is an American poet. I've come to think maybe one of the most important poets working in the English language now. Then of course there's the Ramayana, because this is a book that one never really stops reading. One sort of keeps falling back into it and keeps discovering things in it. So in that sense, I'm still reading Valmiki, you know. So.
Well, thank you so much, Vivek. It's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing it today.
Thank you very much, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.